just a
call to order this hearing of the Committee on State and Local Government Operations and Oversight for Wednesday, February 17th, 2010. First bill on our agenda is Senate File 2565. Senator Scheid.
Well, Madam Chair, did you want us to approve the minutes? Or is that?
Thank you, Senator Betzel. We have the minutes. Are there corrections to the minutes? I was just trying to hurry through here.
Well, we got
to. Everybody wants to be first.
We have to do things right.
But we have to do things in order.
Madam Chair,
I'll call on Senator Scheid. Senator Piggins. Is that what you'd like me to do? We have to adopt the minutes.
Oh, sorry, we can't hear you.
Oh. So it's not my decisions. It's the volume. Is that right? The volume is the problem.
We're trying as best as we can.
Senator Betzel, are there corrections to the minutes?
Madam Chair, I can't see any corrections to the minutes, so I will move the minutes of the February 17th, 2010 minute as written.
You've heard Senator Betzel's motion. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Senator Scheid. Senator Higgins, we will hear Senator Higgins' bill, Senate File 2580, first by agreement of the other authors. Senator Higgins, welcome to the committee. Senator Higgins brings us Senate File 2580, Juneteenth observance modification. Senator Higgins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for letting me go first. We delayed my committee so that I could come
here and do
that. I would like to start by asking if someone would move an amendment on line 7.
What is the amendment?
It would delete June 19th and insert the third Saturday of June.
This is an author's amendment, Senator Pappas.
Yeah, 1-7. Is that what you wanted?
On line 1.7, strike June 19th. And enter and
the third Saturday of June.
The third Saturday.
Or in June or something. I think it's of June.
Of June.
Of June. Of June. So moved.
It was the proper pronunciation here.
I wonder if Mr. Bodern, if it has to be something like the third Saturday of June in each year or. Or does the third Saturday of June take care of Senator Higgins' issue?
Madam Chair, the original language supplied in this bill, which would basically work the same way as the same way other statutes setting certain days, memorial days in statute is written, so I think that will work.
Third Saturday of June?
Yes.
Senator Pappas moves the author's amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Senator Higgins.
Thank you all very much. Senate File 2580 is a proposal designating the third Saturday of June now as Juneteenth, a celebration in recognition of the historic pronouncement of the abolition of slavery on June 19, 1865, and the rich cultural significance that Juneteenth celebrations have been across our state. This observance legislation started out as a state holiday bill, and we were quite surprised to find out how much it would cost. So we have changed it from a holiday to an observance. We think that that will take care of the fiscal impact to the bill. I have with me today Ms. Mary Pargo, who is the chair of the board of Twin Cities Juneteenth, Inc. Dr. Sharon Glover is to her right. Also an advocate for Juneteenth, and we also have with us Deborah Gill Smith, another advocate. And I'll turn it over to Ms. Pargo.
Welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record. We're happy to have your testimony, Ms. Pargo.
Yes, thank you.
You're going to have to really speak up.
Thank you. My name is Mary Pargo. I'm the board chair for the Twin Cities Juneteenth Incorporation, and thank you for having us today. I want to just go into the historical pieces, what Juneteenth is, and why we have it. The historical Juneteenth was said and is critical and very significant earmarks for our country for over 140 years. African Americans all over the country have been celebrating Juneteenth and commemorating the freedom, education, and achievement of African Americans. As we move into today, we know nationally there is a nationwide movement to have Juneteenth, the month of June, marked for a celebration and family gathering in memory of the Emancipation Proclamation, which was set down by our forefather, President Lincoln. And we also are aware that Minnesota Twin Cities Juneteenth was founded in this state 25 years ago. So we found out that we were one of the largest of the celebration that they have for the Juneteenth. And we also know the historical pieces that goes along with it. Today, Juneteenth is hoping that Minnesota will join with the other states and countries that respects and recognize Juneteenth and observance through this important legislation. I don't know if everyone in the room has gotten the handouts, but if you refer to your handouts, you can see the listed states that have already came on board to have Juneteenth recognized as a day of observance.
Thank you, Ms. Pargo. Any questions for Ms. Pargo? Dr. Glover?
Dr. Glover?
Did you want to make a statement?
No, except to say I'm a volunteer with the organization and I support this movement very much.
Dr. Glover, you need to say, for the tape, you need to say your name.
I'm a volunteer with your organization.
You need to say your name, Dr. Glover.
I'm Sharon Glover.
Thank you.
And I just want to say that I am a volunteer with this organization and really support this movement. So many other states have now made this a bill or a day of observance, and I hope that we, too, will do that. Because this is a very significant day and action for our community in large, but particularly for our African-American communities. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Glover.
I just wanted to, in closing, this is Mary Pargo speaking again, say a few words to our co-authors and the Senate staff who helped us. I would like to acknowledge Senator Ann Resch for the opportunity to testify today in the committee and her support as a co-author of the legislation.
Ooh, all of a sudden, yes. Mic came on.
We have microphones.
We have microphones.
Good sound.
So now you can move it back a little bit.
I would also like to thank the Senator Sandra Pappas. Thank you so much, who sit on this committee and co-author in the state of last year the very similar legislation, as well as Senator John Marty. He is a long-time supporter. And finally, Senator Higgins, she has been very supportive of our festival and what happens in her community. And finally, thank you to all the committee people today.
Thank you, Ms. Pargo. Any questions or comments for Senator Higgins? Senator Olsen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Higgins, so there's really no fiscal note or cost to this to the state. It's really just the governor would make the announcement that June 9th. That's my wedding anniversary, actually.
You come out, we'll do something special.
We have a celebration you should come hang out at.
Senator Higgins?
Madam Chair and Senator Olsen, that's right. We originally started out asking for it to be a state holiday.
That, of course, involves all our state employees getting the day off. And even though it was a Saturday, that would then mean they would get Friday off. Well, that comes with about $1.6 million in cost. So we think having it honored in as an observance would give it the stature that we would like. It's less than a holiday, but we don't think
but
that
more
there should
than
be
a proclamation.
Yeah, it's more than a proclamation.
Yes. Yes.
Middle ground, once more.
Right. Senator Pappas.
Ready for a motion?
Absolutely.
Madam Chair, I would move then that Senate Bill 2580, as amended, be recommended to pass.
Senator Pappas moves that Senate File 2580, as amended, be recommended to pass. All who may be in favor of that motion. It has been requested by the Finance Committee. Senator Betzel? Correct? You wanted to see it?
I don't know that I made a request for it, but did I? Maybe Senator Cohen?
Your staff did. Mm-hmm.
Well, and I'll trust my staff then. Let's set it to Finance.
The bill, staff and
right, we'll figure it out.
Senator Pappas moves that Senate File 2580, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank
you
very much,
Senator
Higgins. Thank you. Now, Senator Scheid.
One more committee. What else we got to do?
Senator Scheid, first of all, brings us which. Which one do you want to take up first, Senator Scheid?
Madam Chair, I think you had 2565. An agenda, but I thought I heard you say that earlier.
We have Senate File 2565. This bill is here because it is adding members to the study of aids to local governments, and if we act on it favorably, it will go back to the Tax Committee. Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, and what it does is add two members to the study group, the LGA, the Local Government Aid Study Group, and we are saying that you see the 5 to 6. I think it's actually only adding. No, I think it adds two.
Two.
It does add two. I keep looking at it, and I think, no, I know it adds two because
one each from
the
each
Senate
body.
And the House. Yes, yeah. I'm sorry. So it just doesn't read that easily. But at least then if you look at the other underscored language starting at line 1.14, then we say that at least two of the members, this is why we've added members to the overall group, because we want at least two to represent a city or a group of cities that are not of the first class that are located in the seven county metro area, or the legislator could be from a district, and it explains with at least which at least two-thirds of its population reside in towns, the same towns or cities that are not of the first class in the metropolitan area.
So, Senator Scheid, the effect of this is what?
The effect is to say that at least two of the members, we're going to add two members to the group, and then we're going to say at least two. They don't have to be those two. I mean, they would just be any two of the whole group that are appointed by the chairs of the tax committees and the respective bodies. Oh, all of a sudden.
So there's 12 people on the group.
Yes, there'd be 12 people, and at least two of them then would be from what you would call suburbs.
That's great.
Of
okay.
City of St. Paul or Minneapolis. So, and I have Mr. Burns here from the city of Fridley to speak to this.
What, Brenda? Or what? That's two from each body.
Two from each body.
Two from each body, you're saying.
No,
so four members. No, that's not it.
But, Madam Chair, it might not be worded right. Maybe this is why I'm confused, because you get to that new language on line 14, and it says at least two of the members appointed by each chair, so there would be four members from the suburbs. Is that what you intended?
I'm Bill Burns, the city manager,
Burns?
City manager of Fridley, and I thank you all for allowing me to be here today to promote my cause. My intent in working on this legislation was to have two additional suburban representatives to the LGA study group. Currently, there are 12 members, including the two co-chairs,
No, there are 10 members.
Well, there are 10 members, but Senator Scoey and Representative Marquardt are the co-chairs of the committee. So when you add the 10 representatives to the two chairs, that there are 12. And there are only two suburban reps, and City Manager Ann Norris of Crystal and Senator Scheid of Brooklyn Park. And
yes, no, that's right. I know.
And you're one. And Senator Olson, this doesn't cost anything. It would simply give the suburbs fairer representation on this committee. There's a lot at stake here for suburban city government. Suburban city government does not get a very hefty share of the LGA. We get a very disproportionately small share of the LGA, and I think we ought to be better represented on the LGA study group.
Has this group met?
This group has met once on October 15th. They were scheduled to meet at the third week in January, but to my knowledge, they never did meet.
How many members are minority party members? It says that at least one, but currently, is it one out of the? Is it two out of the ten? One from each body that are Republicans, or what's the mix, Senator Schein?
Madam Chair, I'm not looking at the current makeup. I am so sorry.
I have the mix here.
Okay.
You have to excuse me a second while I.
Okay, I'm just curious.
And Madam Chair, these are not all legislators, so it's just a number of people, so a number could be just nonpartisan.
Well, except that
Thank you.
Two of the members must be members of the Tax Committee.
Mm-hmm.
Must be. It doesn't say you can't have more than that.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just asking who they are.
Madam Chair, there's one Republican and one Democrat from the House, and one Republican and one Democrat from the Senate.
And then the other members are?
A Minneapolis council member from the House, a Minneapolis council member, Crystal City Manager, and a policy analysis manager with the League of Cities. Then in the Senate appointees who are not legislators are the mayor of Cloquet, Chatfield City Clerk, and an analyst with the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. So
the three representatives, non-legislators from the Senate, are all from Greater Minnesota, and the members who are not legislators from the House currently are?
One from the city of Minneapolis, one from a suburb, Crystal, and one who's with the League of Cities.
But there's nobody there from St. Paul, is that?
That's correct.
I think that you are correct.
Okay. And so you're asking for two more members to be legislator members, is that correct?
No, Madam Chair.
No. Just the designation that they represent.
Yes.
Suburban areas in the seven-county metropolitan area.
Right.
Okay. I think I understand it now. Senator Laurie, do you understand it?
Well, I think, I think I get what it was going to, but I didn't understand it when I first read it. There's significant ambiguity in the language here. It's not clear whether the not applies just to the first class or also to located in the seven county metro area. It's worded very awkwardly, such that when I first read it, I applied not to both parts of the sentence, whereas when you described it, it's clear that the so I thought I liked it, but as the more I read it,
well, I did.
I don't have a problem with the current makeup.
I did have help from House Research in writing this.
Okay. Well, I'm not saying, I'm not trying to point fingers. I'm just saying.
The idea is to specifically have a representative appointed by the House and a representative appointed by the Senate that resides or represents what we would generally understand to be suburban interests in the seven county metropolitan area. Is that right?
Madam Chair, that's exactly right.
Correct.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I work in Fridley, and I can testify that they need LGA. The whole month of January, our roads over there were just pure ice. It was just terrible. And I have a chance to say that to the city administrator. But, Madam Chair, I think we need to address the question of the makeup of the body as a whole, because I read previous to these changes that it would be 10 people, not 12 people, because it says at line down by 119 that the chairs of the division of the tax committees having jurisdiction over property taxes shall also be members and shall serve as co-chairs. Does that mean that they're not counted in the?
That's correct. Okay. That means that there are 14 members, and both of those chairs are from Greater Minnesota.
Okay, that's what I wanted to clarify. Thank you. That's correct.
Madam Chair,
Senator Seaman.
Now that I think the committee understands the intent of the legislation, and also I just wanted to add my full support of it and move the bill when it's appropriate.
Okay. Senator Scheid, was this bill a separate bill or last year, or was this something that was put into the tax bill?
Oh, Madam Chair, I guess it was a separate bill. No. Ms. Nauman may be able to help us with
because
this.
Because I think if it was a separate bill and came through this committee, we did not do our job.
Then, Madam Chair,
does not meet our guidelines.
Then, Madam Chair, it must not have been a separate bill.
And I hope that I hope the tax committee doesn't do that again. Senator Sieben moves that Senate File 2565 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Taxes. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Scheid, Senate File 568.
Madam Chair, 568.
We need an amendment.
Is a bill that the committee passed to the floor last year, and so it received its second reading on the 30th of March, I believe, but we did not pursue it. It bounced back to your committee. And I'm here. I don't have any amendments. It was amended in this committee.
You need an amendment for the effective date, Senator
Scheid. Yes,
we do. If you will look at the amendment.
Madam Chair, yes, I think that needs to be 2010 on line 16.
So this is a bill that we have seen before, but would you just explain it one time, and then we'll amendment changing the effective date.
Madam Chair, this bill has to do with offering civil immunity to municipalities that donate public safety equipment. Right now, I don't know if there's much of any donation within Minnesota from one community to another of used, for example, fire equipment, whether it's jackets that may have been worn once or a fire truck that may have been used, you know, multiple times. And having served on the Capital Investment Committee and traveling around the state, I have seen the sore need for equipment around the state, and yet cities and governmental entities are not donating anything within the state because of not having the immunity from liability, but donations are actually being made in places, I think, I don't know if it's as far as South America, but I think Central America, out of the country. And I think this is something that we don't want that result. Doesn't mean you can't make one to another country. You can't make a donation to another country, but we certainly would like to encourage helping other Minnesota municipalities as well to do this. So Mr. Zickman is here, and he might like to add something that
Mr. Zickman, welcome to the committee. If you identify yourself, please, for the record, we welcome your testimony.
Madam Chair, members, Niall Zickman, representing the Minnesota State Fire Chiefs. The bill before you would give us the ability here in Minnesota to donate, whether it's the bunker gear, our air packs, fire trucks themselves, or a host of the other equipment that we have. It's typically coming from, I don't know if I want to describe it as the property-rich metro area, but more of it's coming from that area. Some of it's coming as departments get the assistance to firefighter grants and are able to upgrade and replace that equipment, that they do, in fact, want to donate it, especially in these tough economic times, to the outstate departments. The reality is there's been no lawsuit, so we can't tell you that's happening, but we can tell you the equipment is not getting donated. It's either going into the dumpster or it's going out of state, and in some cases out of the nation. You have to balance, the fact of, all right, there's potentially some risk in lawsuit for the city accepting this accepts that risk. We're not asking that we're going to donate it fraudulently. We'll disclose what's wrong with it. And I would just offer that, I'll use a fire truck as an example. The day after I take delivery of it, the fire truck is used and, in fact, can break down. In fact, they do break down regularly. And so to say at any point we're going to be able to unconditionally donate a piece of equipment, we can do a full preventive maintenance check on that truck or that air pack, and the very next day it can break down, and we wouldn't have any knowledge even if we'd kept it in-house. It's, you know, just the nature of the equipment we use. The same with our gear. One fire, it's got carcinogens on it. One fire. The difference is my firefighters will use that 1,200 times a year. Crane Lake, Minnesota, may use that once every 3 years. So their exposure level is much less, but they would certainly love to have a higher grade of equipment than what they do now. So I'd
And Senator Scheid, this is adding a subdivision to a list. I mean, I think that's important for
of
members to know.
Yes.
A list of exceptions to the liability statute for municipalities. I think, see, it's subdivision 23.
Right.
We need to have an amendment. Senator Betzel
page one,
moves to strike 2009 on line 116 and insert 2010. Everybody see that amendment? It's just changing, updating the effective date. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Did you wish to... Mr. Carlson, is he here? Mr. Carlson, welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself for the record, we'll be grateful for your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members. My name is Joel Carlson. I own a legal research and government affairs business here in St. Paul, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association for Justice. We have concerns about this legislation, and it isn't that we don't support the appropriate donation of working safety equipment. Our problem is that this provides an immunity, a protection for the negligent donation of defective equipment. And while you think that may not happen, and of course we hope that doesn't happen, that is the net effect of the bill. We also have concerns because we believe this language is in conflict with current law. I believe I gave to the page to hand out to committee members what the existing law is right now relative to the donation of public property. And right now, a city council may authorize the donation for nominal or without even consideration public property when it's authorized by a governing body, but it must be donated to another public corporation. And we believe that what is actually going on right now is in conflict with law. We believe that the law currently allows them to dispose of surplus property, but that it should go to another public corporation in Minnesota. And likewise, when a city is accepting gifts from another, they must adopt that by resolution and accept it, including the express terms for the equipment that they're getting. And our position is that they can easily describe this equipment in that adopting resolution, whether it's to give the equipment away or to accept it, which is required by law. And they can and they can among themselves deal with the condition of this property. I have looked across the country, and I have not seen another state that has allowed this blanket immunity for donating defective equipment. I provided to the committee two states, Missouri and Illinois, that have specific programs in place for donating used safety equipment. And those states require that the equipment is either approved or inspected by the state fire marshal, that vehicles that are donated must pass safety inspection, and that the donor inform the city that is donating this equipment, inform the agency that's getting it in writing of any defects. I cannot find another jurisdiction in the country that has allowed life-saving safety equipment to be donated with blanket absolute immunity And we think that this just goes too far. We also think that it is unfair to the taxpayers to be sending our public assets to other jurisdictions without giving other municipalities the option of accepting it. And we think that that is in conflict with current law. This bill does not require that any equipment be donated to another Minnesota municipality. We've asked for that, and that has not been included. In fact, it's been rejected by the fire chief. So we have concerns about this bill that we think with work can be corrected, but there is no procedure in place in this legislation to protect a firefighter from a defective piece of equipment or from a municipality for simply donating out what is a public asset. And so we'd ask that you think about these issues as this move forward, because I think it has unintended consequences both for the disposal of surplus public property and for the life-saving equipment that they're trying to appropriately donate. Thank you, Madam Chairman and members. Be happy to answer any questions.
Are there questions? First of all, maybe Senator Scheid, would you like to respond to Mr. Carlson's concerns, please?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. I do. I think we amended the bill in this committee. I think I want to say it was in response to some of the concerns that Mr. Carlson raised a year ago. Sure.
Because it was amended in the Judiciary Committee, I'm told, Senator Scheid. Not here.
But Madam Chair, I'm sorry. Yeah. It was amended there. Yeah. Forgive me.
But you serve on that committee, so that's probably right. Right. You remember that.
I'm sorry. So, Madam Chair, and I think it was in response to Mr. Carlson's concerns, and it is the language. We only had we had language that said unless the claim, the tort claim resulting from the use donated, unless the claim is a direct result of fraud or intentional misrepresentation, but we added language that's not limited to the failure to disclose known defects or mechanical failures. So I think that was in response to some of Mr. Carlson's concerns. And I don't know, I obviously haven't read all of Chapter 471 or is it 465, and I was looking at those chapters. I don't know that it precludes... I'm not sure if the public corporation is defined as having to be a Minnesota public corporation or not, but it does use the term to another public corporation. So I don't think that the law may not speak to donations to Central America or whatever, but that doesn't mean, I think, that they're precluded from doing that. It's just that when they are donating it or transferring it to another corporation, if you say it's in the state, then there has to be some record of that transfer and that acceptance. But I think that there's a great public good that can come of being able to make these donations without fear of liability. And if you know that there is something wrong with the truck or the gear that you haven't disclosed it, then you would have trouble if you hadn't disclosed it. But I just don't I don't track all the way to the rest of what you said. But
Madam Chair,
Senator Betts,
as you may imagine, the judiciary spent I think quite a bit of time on this particular bill, and I think the idea of if there's intentional misconduct, failure to disclose known defects, I mean, that was the easy part. But I think we wound up having to spend a bit of time thinking about if there's just negligence, should it be gross negligence or simple negligence, because there's a big difference in there. And as you can see from the language, the Judiciary Committee came down on the side of gross negligence, which means you really got to overlook some major problems and so forth, not just stuff that you should have caught, but really goofed up on, and that's, as I say, that's how the bill came to this committee from the Judiciary Committee. So we were cognizant of some of the things, but ultimately the Judiciary Committee came down on the side of wanting to make this happen, but having some recourse if there's defects in the product, but it has to meet these standards.
Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In my Senate district, I think I have 14 volunteer fire departments. And I go to more smelt fries than I can imagine and I can count. And I get to visit with the guys, and I talk to them. Some of them, they buy military surplus tankers and chop them off and make them into tankers to haul in water. They put a lot of time into equipment. And a lot of these departments are mutual aid with a smaller department. So they may be perfectly willing to donate one of their older pieces of equipment to another department that they may actually work with on a mutual aid call. So I think this is a very good bill, and I don't see, like I said, I spent a lot of time with a lot of these firemen, and I don't see them where they would abuse it. I think that they want to help another department that might not be able to have as much revenue and funds as their department, and they want to see them upgrade to better equipment. So I think it's a good bill.
Chair. Senator Sieben, and then I'm going to call on Mr. Carlson again. Senator Sieben.
Senator Scheid, why not do something similar to what Missouri did, though, and require the donating municipality to disclose what the condition of the equipment? What's the problem with more disclosure? Yeah. It would seem that would help both the municipality that's donating it and also the one that's receiving it.
Madam Chair, may Mr. Zickman respond?
Madam Chair, Senator Sieben, one of the difficulties is finding an individual that would be trained and certified to do the examination. Obviously, on a piece of equipment, that's fairly easy or easier, but then there becomes a cost associated with that. But to find a trained technician that is going to do an examination of an air pack or bunker gear, they will simply come back and say, yeah, there's carcinogens on that bunker gear. And then again, you have that cost. The vast majority of the departments in the state, all but 28, are volunteer. They simply don't have the budgets to engage those people, find those people, you know, come up with that report that basically tells them what they already know. I think they do know that, yes, it's used bunker gear, it's been exposed to contaminants, and it is what it is. Yes, it's used air packs. It works fine for us, but it needs to be maintained. You need to do your annual maintenance on it, but it could break tomorrow. It could break tomorrow if we used it. Again, on the equipment, I do have a full-time mechanic. We do a preventive maintenance check on the trucks twice a year. The next week, they break. So even though you do all that, there's still no guarantee, and I think there would be a conscious effort to do as much of that as possible.
Senator Sieben.
Madam Chair and Mr. Zickman, I understand that what you just said, but I guess I still don't understand why not at least let the donating municipality say what they know is wrong with it. So if you're donating a fire truck, say, you know, this, and this has gone wrong, and put that in writing to give to the city that's receiving the equipment.
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, if I may, I mean, on lines 11 and 12, it does say that they would not be exempted from civil liability for failure to disclose known defects or mechanical failures. I mean, they'd be required.
I think that's the clause there. Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair and members, just so the committee is clear, we do not oppose the appropriate donation of this equipment, just so you're clear on that point. But you need to understand that gross negligence, this says that if I'm grossly negligent in my failure to disclose, gross negligence in Minnesota is no care at all. That's the law. So if I use no care at all and give it away, even though I may be negligent, maybe I know something, that's what gross negligence is. And when the bill went to judiciary, it said misconduct, gross negligence, and negligence, and we were much more comfortable with the bill. When it was like all other areas of municipal tort liability where they're responsible under Chapter 466 for their negligence. But this says gross negligence, no care at all, or intentional misconduct, and we hope that, of course, never happens. But gross negligence is an absolute immunity because that is no care at all. And we believe that there is a way to do this. We've tried to work with Senator Scheid, and we want to see something happen in this regard, but we just don't think that there's adequate disclosure. Mr. Zickman just said that we know this stuff has problems, and we're going to give it away for someone to use with no care at all. And that is just too high of a standard.
What occurs to me is something that I'd like to think I seldom forget, and that is what the jurisdiction of this committee is. Mm-hmm. And the notion of negligence or simple negligence is a Judiciary Committee issue. It is not one for this committee, even though we took your testimony with regard to that. And the why is this bill here? This bill come here to start. The reason why it came here to start with from the Judiciary Committee, because it says relating to civil law, is because it deals with local governments. But the Judiciary Committee issues of liability are not our jurisdiction. So I think that we don't properly respond to your concerns here, Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair, members, Senator Betzold opened the door on the liability issue, and I was only responding to it.
Yes.
I tried to confine my comments to the appropriate donation, the resolution that's required by the city.
Yes, you did.
The resolution accepting it by the city, and the ability of these municipalities somehow in this language to acknowledge the state of that equipment when they're donating it and when they're accepting it. And that's why I tried to confine my comments to that. And I think that's achievable and is a worthwhile a public adventure, because we do not want defective safety equipment to be donated.
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I don't want to continue down the road concerning the negligence. It's just that I'm looking at the original bill, and it didn't mention negligence of any sort, negligence or gross negligence. We added that in the Judiciary Committee, but we are saying, I mean, I think you have to disclose known defects or mechanical failures. I believe that's what that's saying. Unless there's intentional misconduct or gross negligence, and that includes, not limited to, but includes the failure to disclose known defects or mechanical failures. So there is notice. It's not just gross negligence. We're saying that that's included in things that must be disclosed.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Scheid, I like your bill just like it is. And the thing that I don't understand is why wouldn't most of the burden for making sure that something is functioning well be on the recipient before they use it, instead of the person who's simply giving it. I would think that the recipient would be the one that would have the responsibility to truly check out the equipment before they sent their firefighters out with it. And I really think that someone who's making a donation should not be held to any higher accountability for that equipment than what the proposal currently says.
It would seem to me that, I mean, we can have the copy of the mTOR rule, let the buyer beware in a sense, but it would seem to me that there is, if the donor holds out the equipment, even though used, as being usable and safe, that the recipient should be able to rely. I mean, there's got to be a balance of being able to rely on that as well as checking it out yourself after you received it. I mean, we see signs when we buy used things, as is, and with there's no expectations that an item has met any standard at all. So I think it gets into it's a balancing. I mean, I like the bill too, but I think it's a balancing act between responsibilities of the donor and responsibilities of the recipient with regard to something that is indeed safety equipment.
Right, but Senator Roman, Chair, when we say it has to be usable, it could come with the condition that, I mean, suppose they disclose that some pump isn't working quite right on the pumper, and the donor isn't going to pay to have that repaired. But the recipient knows it might not be usable when they get it because the pump has to be repaired.
That's why I made the comment that you get the pump as is.
Right. And so, I'm thinking, yes, it's good so that they don't then have a piece of big equipment that they have to dispose of, which is a new cost and burden for the recipient. I think the language as it's written. And we're talking about our fire departments here. What is their duty? It is to help in time of need. And I don't think they're going to be trying to rip off another department and intentionally deceive them just so they can unload a bad piece of equipment. I think, to imply that somebody's going to try and do that is just kind of out of the world of reality that we're dealing with here.
Senator Olsen.
Madam Chair, one last point, if I may. Since the Richfield Fire Chief is here, I asked, because I couldn't remember if fire trucks were subject to the annual DOT inspections, and he told me that they were. So then you've got on record, if it's got a good current DOT, it's gone through that safety inspection. So unless, as Senator Roebling pointed out, there's a bad pump or something, you can know that the chassis is in a safe, operable condition.
Mr. Zygmunt is a fire chief, too.
I could have asked him, too.
You could have asked him, yes. Senator Scheid, anything further?
Madam Chair, no, I don't.
Is there a motion?
Madam Chair, where's
it? Senator Bickman? Bickerman?
Where's it go from?
Go back to the floor.
That went to judiciary.
I can catch myself on either side of this.
Came from there.
Because I bought a tractor, and I knew the guy personally. That tractor is in tip-top shape. Within an hour, the engine blew.
Ooh.
Now, it wasn't his fault. It was not his fault. That just happened to be one of those things that happened. And I trust my fireman enough. You wouldn't give somebody else a poor piece of equipment. It'll make sense. Why would you do that?
Senator Vickerman, we wouldn't. Not knowingly.
Senator Olsen.
Madam Chair, I'd be honored to move the bill.
Senator Olsen moves that Senate file 568 as amended be recommended to pass. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you very much.
Thank you, members.
Senator Scheid, Mr. Bickman, Mr. Carlson. Senator Kielash. Senator Kielash, Senate file 2400 is before us.
Yet there's equipment that they don't need that they could get you.
But it could break down the next time, it seems.
Yeah, when that pumper isn't working, we can fix it.
Senator Kielash, want to explain your bill?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for have Senate file 2400. This bill will allow Richfield Fire Department to impose a response time requirements for new hires. With me today is Brad Swam, Richfield Fire Chief. He brought this bill to my attention and is here to help explain to the committee just a moment what we're looking at. I also have firefighter Dennis LeMay and the president of Minnesota Professional Firefighters, Mr. Thornburg. So, I'd like to mention that the Firefighters Union worked with Mr. Swem and to create a non-controversial language on this bill, and is my understanding that there will be representation here today, which we have, to address any questions regarding the petition of this bill. And with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Swem.
So essentially, the response time translates into a residency requirement in terms
Madam
of being
Chair,
close
it,
to a fire station.
It does not, because within Richfield's 10 minutes from Richfield could be either Minneapolis, Eagan, Bloomington, Medina.
No, I didn't mean that. I meant not necessarily resident of Richfield, but
yes.
You have to be a nearby resident regardless of what municipality you live in.
Madam Chair, that's right.
That was the compromise in this, yes. Welcome to the committee. If you'd like to, identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for hearing us today. My name is Brad Swem. I'm the fire chief with the Richfield Fire Department. And as probably we're here because currently state statute, there's a statute that prohibits cities essentially in the seven-county metro area from establishing residency requirements for any employment. And we have worked together closely, labor management, with our Dennis LeMay, who is our local firefighters union president, and with President Tom Thornburg of the MPFF, to come up with a wording and or legislation that would give us a residency requirement, basically, for new hires for 10, they'd have to live within 10 minutes for 10 years. We are a small career department, Richfield is. We handle about 90-95% of our emergency runs on a daily basis with our normal on-duty staffing. However, 100 to 150 times a year, we rely on our off-duty firefighters to respond back quickly to backfill for when all of our crew, on-duty crew, is busy or tied up. That occurs at structure fires, many simultaneous events, and also when we go provide mutual aid to our neighboring communities. Over the years, our members that have lived close has dwindled. Probably opportunities to get nicer housing further out, the desire to be a little further away. So we've kind of lost that that pool of people close by that we could call back. Having the ability to recall our off-duty personnel and get them back in rapidly, and it's usually the front end of most incidents. It's probably the first 30 minutes is when it's very critical. It really leverages our capabilities to provide a good service, provide safety to both the community, the other firefighters, and I believe is a very effective and economical use of our resources. But again, we need some ability to, at least for a part of their career, have them living a little closer to us, and that's why we're here today. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Svem. Mr. LeMay, if you would identify yourself for the record.
Dennis LeMay, president of the local union for Richfield Firefighters. Madam Chair, Senators, we have worked with Chief Svem and the city administrator and the state. What would be the best for us on this is it just gives us another option on keeping the services that we have. We are a small department. 30 years ago or so, before the residency laws changed, we did have people living in, and it allowed us to have a smaller department, keep the finances as low as they are, one of the cheapest in the metro area, actually, per capita, and have the service be very quick, very rapid, and be able to do that third or fourth call that came in that would overwhelm the on-duty crew. With the new statutes, even though the outstate and the volunteer departments are able to have residency things, we are not even able to discuss it, discuss it amongst ourselves as a possible option. And this would open up an option for us to keep the services as good as we've got them.
Mr. Thornburg, did you have any further comment to make?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tom Thornburg, president of the Minnesota Professional Firefighters. Normally, I'm not an advocate of residency rules, but in the case of Richfield, I am. I've worked with the local and with the chief, and they're a full-time department. They don't have any volunteers or paid on calls, so it's crucial that they are able to call back their members in the instances that the chief mentioned earlier. I think this is a good bill. It serves Richfield very well. It's not a residency rule. It's a response time bill. There's many other adjacent communities that are within 10 minutes of the fire station, so their members could respond, which opens up other school districts in which their members could live. I think that would serve their members well. The local union supports it. And it does have a trial period of 7 years. So I think we'll be watching this very closely to see if it is successful.
Are there questions for Senator Kielash or his witnesses? Senator Betzel.
Well, first of all, thank you, Madam Chair. The last comment about it expires for 7 years, I see that. The issue that comes up often on these local bills, sometimes you come in with a very specific local bill and the question is, well, this may apply to other jurisdictions. Why isn't broader? And sometimes somebody will come in with a very broad bill, and they say, well, if it's only going to apply to one jurisdiction, why don't you narrow your bill? So we've kind of gone both ways. I just wonder if, you know, if this becomes law, that we may have other cities coming in saying they want the same thing. I mean, Robbinsdale, New Hope, Fridley, Blaine.
We don't have our fire departments are a mix. I think this is a full-time professional firefighting okay. department, not volunteers. And I think my communities have a mix of full-time and volunteer.
So would we be seeing other bills, though, or not, from other communities?
I don't know. Mr. Thornburg, do you have a response of what if other communities are, or is Richfield unique?
Thank you, Madam Chair, to Senator Bentzel. Richfield is unique. They are full-time. They have no paid-on calls. They have no volunteers. There are other surrounding communities. Edina, for instance, is a full-time fire department, but they do have paid-on call people as well. Richfield does not. It's strictly a full-time department. And I don't know of any others in the seven-county metro area that are strictly just full-time departments that don't have the backup of the paid-on call or a volunteer department.
Anyone else? Senator Carlson?
Madam Chair, and I guess anyone can answer that, but how do you measure the response time, and is it to a particular a station or to some central location, City Hall, something like that? And then also, what about if things change, if there's road changes, if there's something else that gets pushes you to 11 minutes, for instance? How do you measure that, and what standards do you use?
Madam Chair, Senator, our 10 minutes is a driving time. There's several ways to measure it, and we would probably be somewhat liberal on that application. There's through GIS mapping, not to be flippant, but even MapQuest will give you driving time. So if there are GIS programs out there that you can calculate drive time fairly accurately. So that would be one way. Probably also actual driving it through various times of the day to see it. And we would understand that there could be some variances. What might make it in 8 minutes sometimes could be 12 the next. And that's something I think we would all have to live with. As far as road changes, if a road was blocked off and someone now is the best they could do is 12, that's out of it, both ours and that person's control, and I think that'd be something we'd have to just live with.
Madam Chair.
Senator Kielash.
Madam Chair, Senator Carlson, the bill says that the time it may not require any response time less than 10 minutes. It does not mean that somebody 12 minutes away would not be eligible for this job. So it's just setting a lower limit, not an upper limit on that. And considering that Richfield is surrounded by freeways, including 62 Crosstown, and the constant blockage, we would expect that to be an ongoing issue for a while with the construction going there. But it's still an effort to try to respond to this community's needs for their fire department.
Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What are your typical shifts? Are they like a 24-hour shift?
Madam Chair, Senator, our shifts are 24-hour shifts. It averages out to a firefighter will work one 24-hour shift and have 48 hours off, two shifts off. That's the average. So they roughly are off two-thirds of the time, and to be able to use them, call them back rapidly is very effective for us. Answering the other senator's question regarding where that would be measured from, we have two fire stations, and we would measure from either one of those stations, whichever equates out that 10-minute circumference around there.
Senator Olsen.
Follow-up. Thank you, Madam Chair. The reason I ask is in my district, which is probably 50 miles north of Minneapolis and St. Paul, there's a number of Minneapolis and St. Paul firefighters there, and I thought there was litigation that they couldn't be required to, they could only set like a half hour time limit or something on where they lived. And so could you update me on what the current law is or if that is a law?
Mr. Thornburg, do you know?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator. It's seven-county metro area. There is no residency requirement. Or by law, there cannot be a residency requirement within some county metro area.
Senator Olsen?
So then we're making – this would be an exception to the law if we were to move forward with this.
Madam Chair, Senator, that is correct.
Senator Roebling – or Senator Olsen, did you have further?
Just quickly, I'm just wondering if there would – I know the union members seem to be going along with this, but I wonder if somebody wouldn't challenge this in court because as previous testimony – there might be, you know, somebody else said, well, they're getting it, and now I wonder if this wouldn't end up in court down the road.
Could Dennis LeMay address
Mr.
part
LeMay.
Of it, too? The state statute exempts the Twin Cities area from the city and the unions requiring anything like that. However, outstate and all the volunteer paid-on calls, even if they are in the metro, are able to do this. So
if it's in law.
For the full-time members, departments in the Twin Cities area, we don't even have an option of discussing this, whereas everyone else can. Edina mentioned that they have a paid on call, but because they are paid on call, they are able to put a restriction on their people. Then that's how they keep enough people close in to cover some of their backfills. So what this is doing is allow us to basically be on par with those departments.
Senator Roebling?
Thank you. And I think it's a good idea. The only question I have is, if it is a small department, how many people do you have serving in their first 10 years? Do you have enough new people that'll provide you the coverage that you need?
Chief Sim.
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling. That's a very good question. And there's a couple philosophies that we had with that. The first 10 years would give us a pool, if we look at the normal lifespan and attrition through the department, the average age or time on the department, I should say, would give us enough people to staff back adequately on most occasions. And certainly if after 10 years some would move out, that's and we've kind of factored that in, certainly making some assumptions. But I'm sure some would, after 10 years, elect to stay within that same area if they, you know, establish a family, put down some roots too. So I don't think, in reality, after 10 years, everybody under that rule or regulation would move further out. So we would retain some of those even at that point.
Madam Chair?
Senator Roebling.
Is this mainly for new hires or it's people who are already there? It's just for new hires?
Strictly for people hired after the date if it was indeed enacted.
Okay, thanks.
Senator Lori.
Madam Chair, that's the point I was going to make is that it's actually a 10-year clock per each employee. So it's not like in 10 years there's this wave of employees that suddenly is able to move out. It's that, you know, each new hire, as they come on, starts a 10-year clock for them. And so, you know, hopefully.
It's individual. Senator Carlson?
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Chief, how would you determine this, the time frame you're talking about, the amount of minutes of response you're talking about, and also would that be by council action? I mean, it sounds like there could be sometimes some labor management relations problems here, and what would you use to change it? Would that be council action again?
Chief Sven?
Madam Chair, Senator Carlson, if I'm understanding your question correctly, or it might have been two parts, the first part as far as determining that is a residence within 10 minutes of a fire station, we would look at, as I previously mentioned, there's GIS mapping techniques to determine typical or drive times. That would be one way. We would probably actually look at.
Madam Chair and Mr. Chief,
Senator
I'm
Carlson.
Speaking of how you would determine what number of minutes you would set, not the measurement, but if the council said we're going to go to 15 minutes, for instance, or we're going to go to 13 minutes.
Chief Sven.
Madam Chair, Senator Carlson, that is specified in the language of the bill. It is 10 minutes. They have to live within 10 minutes or less.
Madam Chair, I'll have the bill.
Senator Roebling.
For that.
It's clarification.
Not less than. They can't require a response time that is less than.
I'm sorry.
10 minutes. Not 10 minutes or less, but less than 10 minutes.
And Dennis, main senator, maybe I can clarify from the union point of view on that also. We would work together with them, and it's not going to be an arbitrary number. We're going to look at past experience. How often do we get another call in when we're on short? What kind of time frames? We're not going to come up with just
They could require 15 minutes, but they can't require less than 10.
Anything less would almost make it within the city, which would not be what anybody required. And as far as city council would, even if we agreed, the city council by the statute would have to agree to this also. Okay. So it's not just something we'd come up with and enlist. The city council has to be on board also.
Thank you.
Senator Roebling moves that Senate file 2400 be recommended to pass.
Madam Chair?
Senator Bessel.
Just as a clarification, I consult with the council on that. Apparently, we do not need a local approval clause because this is permissive. So council says that we don't need to do that. I just wanted to make sure that we're on that page.
And there is no local approval clause here. Right?
Madam Chair, there isn't a need for it.
That's why there's not, because it's permissive. Yeah. Okay. It doesn't require them to do this based on local approval. It just simply starts out by saying they can do this or not do this. Thank you, Senator Betzel. So Senator Roebling moves that Senate file 2400 be recommended to pass. All the favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. That concludes our agenda for today. Mm-hmm. On Wednesday, we are taking up. We have a full slate of bills, and I did have an inquiry earlier about when we were going to come back to confirmations, and
we don't have a date set.
We don't have a date set for that, but there are a number of people that missed our first confirmation hearing.